started out as such a promising breakthrough, but it's certainly turned into a mess. I saw a private report from the Department of Energy which forecasts a much bleaker environmental and economic impact from global warming than anybody else is letting on. The latest studies indicate the atmospheric greenhouse gases are growing at an alarming rate. Do you think a source of ruthenium can be found quickly enough to make the artificial photosynthesis system a reality? All we've got is a tenuous historical account of a long-forgotten source. It might turn up empty, but the best we can do is track it down. Pitt turned down a quaint residential street lined with historic mansions that dated to the 1840s. Finding a parking spot beneath a towering oak tree, they made their way to a smaller residence constructed from the carriage house of an adjacent manor. Pitt rapped a heavy brass knocker, and the front door flew open a moment later, revealing a colossal man clad in a red satin smoking jacket. "Dirk! Lauren! There you are," St. Julian Perlmutter boomed in a hearty voice. The bearded behemoth, who tipped the scales at nearly 400 pounds, gave them each a spine-crushing hug as he welcomed them into his house. "Julian, you were looking fit. Have you lost some weight?" Lauren said, patting his ample belly. "Heavens no," he roared. "The day I stop eating is the day I die. You, on the other hand, look more ravishing than ever." "You best keep that appetite of yours focused on food," Pitt threatened with a grin. Perlmutter leaned down to Lauren's ear. "If you ever get tired of living with this adventuresome old cuss, you just let me know," he said, loud enough for Pitt to hear. Then, rising like a bear, he pounded across the room. "Come to the dining room," he beckoned. Lauren and Pitt followed him past the entryway, through a living room and down a hallway, all of which were filled to the ceiling with shelved books. The entire house was similarly cluttered, resembling a stately library more than a personal residence. Within its walls were the largest single collection of historic maritime books and journals in the world. An insatiable collector of nautical archives, Perlmutter himself stood as a preeminent expert on maritime history. Perlmutter led them to a small but ornate dining room, where only a few piles of books were discreetly stacked against one wall. They took their seats at a thick mahogany table that featured legs carved in the shape of lion paws. The table had come from the captain's cabin of an ancient sailing ship, one of many nautical antiques tucked among the legion of books. Perlmutter opened a bottle of Puy Fumé, then poured each of them a glass of the dry white wine. "I'm afraid I already finished off that bottle of Irag that you sent me from Mongolia," he said to Pitt. "Marvelous stuff." "I had plenty while I was there. The locals consume it like water," he replied, recalling the slightly bitter taste of the alcoholic drink made from mare's milk. Perlmutter tasted the wine, then set down his glass and clapped his hands. "Marie," he called loudly, "you may serve the soup." An apron-clad woman appeared from the kitchen carrying a tray of bowls. The physical opposite of Perlmutter, she was lithe and petite, with short dark hair and coffee-colored eyes. She silently placed a bowl of soup in front of each diner with a smile, then disappeared into the kitchen. Pitt took a taste and nodded. "Vichyssoise, very flavorful." Perlmutter leaned forward and spoke in a whisper. "Marie is an assistant chef at Citronelle here in Georgetown. She is a graduate from one of the top culinary schools in Paris. Better than that, her father was a chef at Maxim's," he added, kissing his fingertips in delight. "She agreed to come cook for me 3 times a week. "Life is good," he declared in a deep bellow, the folds of fat around his chin rolling as he laughed. The trio dined on sautéed sweetbreads with risotto and leeks, followed by a chocolate mousse. Pitt pushed his empty dessert plate away with a sigh of satisfaction. Lauren threw in the towel before finishing hers. "Outstanding, Julian, from start to finish. If you ever grow tired of maritime history, I do believe you'd have a fantastic future as a restaurateur," Lauren said. "Perhaps. But I believe there would be too much work involved," Perlmutter said with a laugh. "Besides, as you surely have learned from your husband, one's love for the sea never wanes."
"True. I don't know what you two would do with yourselves if man had never sailed the seas."
Blasphemous thought, Perlmutter boomed. Which reminds me, Dirk, you said your calling involved something more than just fine dining with a dear friend. That's right, Julian. I'm on the hunt for a scarce mineral that made an appearance in the Arctic around 1849. Sounds intriguing. What's your interest? Pitt summarized the importance of ruthenium and the tale of the Inuit ore from the miners' co-op. Adelaide Peninsula, you say? If my memory serves, that's just below King William Island, dead center in the Northwest Passage, Perlmutter said, stroking his thick gray beard. And in 1849, the only explorers in that region would have been Franklin's party. Who was Franklin? Lauren asked. Sir John Franklin, British naval officer and renowned Arctic explorer. Fought at Trafalgar on the Bellerophon as a young lad, if I recall. Though a little past his prime at age 59, he sailed with two stoutly built ships in an attempt to find and navigate the fabled Northwest Passage. He came within a hair of pulling it off, but his ships became trapped in the ice. The surviving men were forced to abandon the ships and attempt to reach a fur trading camp hundreds of miles to the south. Franklin and all 134 men of his expedition party ultimately died, making it by far the worst tragedy in Arctic exploration. Perlmutter excused himself to visit one of his reading rooms, returning with several old books and a crudely bound manuscript. Flipping through one of the books, he stopped at a page and read aloud. Here we are. Franklin sailed from the Thames in May of 1845 with two ships, the Erebus and the Terror. They were last seen entering Baffin Bay off Greenland later that summer. With provisions to last the crew 3 years, they were expected to winter at least 1 year in the ice before attempting a path to the Pacific, or else return to England with proof that a passage did not exist. Franklin and his crew instead perished in the Arctic, and his ships were never seen again. Didn't anyone go looking for them when they failed to appear after 3 years? Lauren asked. Oh, my dear, did they? Concern grew by the end of 1847 when no word had been heard, and relief efforts commenced the next year. Literally dozens of relief expeditions were sent in search of Franklin, with vessels prodding both ends of the passage. Franklin's wife, Lady Jane Franklin, famously financed numerous expeditions single-handedly to locate her husband. Remarkably, it wouldn't be until 1854, 9 years after they departed England, that the remains of some of the crewmen were found on King William Island, confirming the worst. Did they leave any logbooks or records behind? Pitt asked. Just one. A chilling note that was placed in a rock cairn on the island and discovered in 1859. Perlmutter found a photocopy of the note in one of his books and slid it over for Lauren and Pitt to read. There's a notation that Franklin died in 1847, but it doesn't say why, Lauren read. The note raises more questions than answers. They were tantalizingly close to transiting the worst section of the passage, but may have been caught by an exceedingly short summer, and the ships probably broke up in the ice. Pitt found a map in the book which showed the area of Franklin's demise. The point where his ships were presumed abandoned was less than 100 miles from Adelaide Peninsula. The ruthenium found in the region was referred to as Black Kabluna, Pitt said, searching for a potential geographic clue on the chart. Kabluna? That's an Inuit word, Perlmutter said, pulling out the crudely bound manuscript. Opening the ancient parched papers, Lauren saw that the entire document was handwritten. Yes, Pitt answered. It is an Inuit term for white man. Perlmutter wrapped a knuckle on the open document. In 1860, a New York journalist named Stuart Leutner sought to unravel the mystery of the Franklin expedition. He traveled to the Arctic and lived in an Inuit settlement for 7 years, learning their language and customs. He scoured the region around King William Island, interviewing every inhabitant he could find who had possibly interacted with Franklin or his crew. But the clues were few, and he returned to New York disillusioned, never finding the definitive answers he was looking for. For some reason, he decided against publishing his findings and left his writings behind to return to the Arctic. He took a young Inuit wife, then ventured into the wild to live off the land, and was never heard from again. Is that his journal from his time among the Inuit? Pitt asked. Perlmutter nodded. I was able to acquire it at auction a few years back, picking it up at a reasonable price.
I'm amazed it was never published, Lauren said.
You wouldn't be if you read it. 90% of it is a discourse on catching and butchering seals, building igloos, and surviving the boredom of the dark winter months.
And the other 10%? Pitt asked.
Let us see. Perlmutter smiled. For the next hour, Perlmutter skimmed through the journal, sharing occasional passages where an Inuit described witnessing a sledge party on the distant shores of King William Island, or noted the two large ships trapped in the ice. Near the very end of the journal, Leutner interviewed a young man whose story put Lauren and Pitt on the edge of their seats. The account was from Kunik, a 13-year-old boy in 1849 when he went on a seal-hunting excursion with his uncle west of King William Island. He and his uncle had climbed a large hummock and found a massive boat wedged in a large ice floe. Kobluna, the uncle had said, as they made their way to the vessel. As they moved closer, they heard much yelling and screaming coming from the depths of the ship. A wild-eyed man with long hair waved for them to come alongside. With a freshly caught seal for barter, they were quickly invited onto the deck. Several more men appeared, dirty and emaciated, with dried blood covering their clothes. One of the men stared at Kunik, babbling incoherently as two other men danced around the deck. The crew sang an odd chant, calling themselves the Men of Blackness. They all seemed possessed by evil spirits, Kunik thought. Frightened by the specter, Kunik clung to his uncle as the elder man traded the seal meat for two knives and some shiny silver stones that the Kablunas said had unique warming powers. The Kablunas promised more cutting tools and silver stones if the Inuit returned with more seal meat. Kunik left with his uncle, but never saw the boat again. He reported that his uncle and some other men took a large number of seals to the boat a few weeks later and returned with many knives and a kayak filled with the black Kobluna.
It had to have been the ruthenium, Lauren said excitedly.
Yes, the black Kobluna, Pitt agreed. But where did Franklin's crew acquire it? It might possibly have been discovered on one of the neighboring islands during a sledging excursion while the ships were locked in the ice, Perlmutter ventured. Of course, a mine could have been discovered much earlier in the expedition, anywhere from Greenland to Victoria Island, covering a distance of well over 1,000 miles. Not much to go on, I'm afraid.
What I find strange is the behavior of the crew, Lauren noted.
I heard a similar tale of some mill workers in South Africa going loony, which was blamed on possible exposure to ruthenium, Pitt replied. None of it makes sense, though, as there is nothing inherently dangerous about the mineral.
Perhaps it was just the horrible conditions they endured, starving and freezing all those winters, trapped in a dark, cramped ship, Lauren said. That would be enough to drive me crazy.
Throw in scurvy and frostbite, not to mention botulism brought on from a shoddy supply of tinned food sealed with lead, and you would have plenty to test a man's wits, Perlmutter agreed. Just one of several unanswered questions associated with the expedition, Pitt said. The account seems to confirm your trader's story from the miners' co-op, Perlmutter noted.
Maybe the answer to where the mineral came from still lies on the ship, Lauren suggested.
Pitt was already mulling the same thought. He knew that the frigid waters of the Arctic allowed for remarkable preservation of antiquities. The Breadalbin, an 1843 wooden ship sent on one of the Franklin rescue expeditions and crushed in the ice near Beachy Island, had recently been discovered fully intact, its masts even still rising over the deck. That a clue to the source of the ruthenium might still exist on the ship was entirely possible. But what ship was it, and where was it located?
There was no mention of a second ship, he asked.
No, Perlmutter replied, and the approximate location they provide is quite a bit farther south than where the Franklin ships were recorded to have been abandoned.
Maybe the ice drifted, moving them apart, Lauren suggested.
Entirely plausible, Perlmutter replied.
Leutner has an interesting tidbit later in the journal, he said, flipping a few pages forward. A third-party Inuit claims to have seen one of the ships sink while the other one disappeared. Leutner could never quite decipher the distinction from the Inuit. Assuming it is one of the Franklin ships, it might well be critical to identify the vessel, in case the mineral was not brought aboard both Erebus and Terror, Pitt noted. I'm afraid Kunik never identified the ship, and both vessels were nearly identical in appearance, Perlmutter said.
But he said the crew had a name for themselves, Lauren said. What did he call them? The Black Men?
The Men of Blackness is how they were described, Perlmutter replied. Somewhat odd. I suppose they called themselves that for having survived so many dark winters.
Or there might be another reason, Pitt said, a wide grin slowly spreading across his face.
If they were indeed the Men of Blackness, then they just told us which ship they served.
Lauren looked at him with a quizzical gaze, but the light went on for Perlmutter.
But of course, the big man roared. It must be the Erebus. Well done, my boy.
Lauren looked at her husband. What did I miss?
Erebus, Pitt replied. In Greek mythology, it is an underworld stopping place on the road to Hades. It is a place of perpetual darkness, or blackness, if you will. Fair to say, that's where the ship and crew ended up, Perlmutter said. He gave Pitt a studious look. Do you think you can find her?
It will be a sizable search area, but it's worth the gamble. The only thing that can prevent us from succeeding is the same peril that doomed Franklin. The ice.
We are nearing the summer season, where the melting sea ice is navigable in the region. Can you get a vessel there in time to conduct a search?
And don't forget the Canadians, Lauren cautioned. They might not let you in the door.
Pitt's eyes sparkled with optimism. It just so happens that I have a vessel in the neighborhood and the man in place to find the way, he said with a confident grin. Perlmutter located a dusty bottle of vintage port wine and poured small glasses all around. Godspeed to you, my boy, he toasted. May you shed some light on the darkened Erebus. After thanking Perlmutter for the meal and receiving a promise from the marine historian that he would provide copies of any materials he had on the ship's likely position, Lauren and Pitt stepped out of the carriage house and returned to the car. Climbing into the car, Lauren was unusually quiet. Her sixth sense had kicked in, warning of an unseen danger. She knew she couldn't stand in the way of Pitt pursuing a lost mystery, but it was always hard for her to let him go.
The Arctic is a dangerous place, she finally said in a low voice. I'll worry about you up there.
I'll be sure to pack my long underwear and stay well clear of icebergs, he said with cheery comfort.
I know this is important, but still, I wish you didn't have to go.
Pitt smiled in reassurance, but in his eye there was a distant and determined look. Lauren took one look at her husband and knew that he was already there. Chapter 42 Mitchell Goyette was sitting on the fantail of his yacht reviewing an earnings report when his private secretary appeared with a secure portable phone.
Natural Resources Minister Jameson is on the line, the winsome brunette said as she handed him the phone.
Goyette gave her a smug leer, then picked up the receiver.
Arthur, good of you to call. Tell me, how are you getting along with my Arctic exploration licenses?
It is the purpose of my call.
I received the maps of your desired Arctic resource exploration zones. The requested regions encompass over 12 million acres, I was rather shocked to find. Quite unprecedented, I must say.
Yes, well, there are riches to be had. First things first, however. Where are we on those mining claims for the Royal Geographical Society Islands?
As you know, a portion of the island's exploration and production rights are held by the Mid-America Mining Company. My office has drafted up a revocation of their license for due cause. If they fail to meet production output quotas in the next 3 months, then we can rescind their license. If this political crisis with the U.S. heats up, then we may be able to act sooner.
I think we can be assured that they won't meet their summer quota, Goyette said slyly. The rescission can be accelerated if signed by the Prime Minister. Is that a course you wish to pursue?
Prime Minister Barrett will be no impediment, Goyette laughed. You might say he is something of a silent partner in the venture.
He's publicly promoted a policy of Arctic wilderness protectionism, Jameson reminded him.
He will sign anything I want him to. Now what about my other license request?
My staff has found just a small portion of the Melville Sound area currently under license.
Apparently you've beaten most everyone to the mark.
Yes, because a large part of the area has been inaccessible. With the warming temperatures and my fleet of icebreakers and barges, I'll be able to exploit those regions before anyone else can get their foot in the door.
With your aid, of course, he added acidly.
I'll be able to assist with your Arctic Marine Exploration licenses, but a portion of the terrestrial areas will have to be approved by the Indian and Native Affairs Division.
Is the head of the division appointed by the Prime Minister?
Yes, I believe so.
Goyette laughed again.
Then there will be no problem. How long before I can lock up the marine sites?
It is a significant amount of territory to review and approve, Jameson said with hesitation.
Don't you worry, Minister. A fat wire transfer will be headed your way shortly, and another one once the licenses are issued. I never forget to pay those who assist me in my business ventures.
Very well. I'll try to have the documents completed within the next few weeks.
That's my boy. You know where to find me, Goyette said, then hung up the phone. In his office in Ottawa, Jameson hung up the phone and looked across his desk. The commissioner of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police turned off a recording device, then hung up the second handset on which he had been listening in.
My God, he has indicted the Prime Minister as well, the commissioner muttered, shaking his head.
Deep pockets easily corrupt, Jameson said. You will have my immunity agreement by tomorrow.
Yes, the commissioner replied, visibly shaken.
You agree to turn state's evidence and there will be no criminal charges filed against you. You will, of course, be expected to resign your post immediately. I'm afraid your career in public service will effectively be over.
I can accept that fate, Jameson replied with a sullen look. It will be preferable to continuing as an indentured servant to that greedy swine.
Can you live with taking down the Prime Minister as well?
If Prime Minister Barrett is in Goyette's pocket, then he deserves no less. The commissioner rose from his chair and packed the listening device and a notepad into an attaché case.
Don't look so distraught, Commissioner, Jameson said, observing his troubled expression. Once the truth about Goyette is revealed, you'll be a national hero for putting him away. In fact, you would make a good law and order candidate for the Prime Minister's replacement.
My aspirations don't run that high. I'm just dreading the havoc a billionaire will wreak on the criminal justice system.
As he stepped toward the door, Jameson called out to him once more.
Right will win out eventually.
The commissioner kept on walking, knowing it wasn't always the case.
Chapter 43. The exposed portion of Trevor's boat was still smoldering when a lift barge, borrowed from the aluminum smelter, moored alongside and hoisted the wrecked vessel aboard. Chugging to a nearby boatyard, the barge deposited the waterlogged hulk onto a cement pad, where it would await investigation by the police and an insurance claims adjuster. His cuts bandaged and his report to the police completed, Trevor poked through the charred hull, then made his way back over to the Numa research boat. Dirk waved him aboard, inquiring about the police response.
The chief isn't ready to concede it was a planted explosion until his arson investigator can have a look, Trevor said.
Boats just don't blow up. Certainly not in that fashion, Dirk replied.
He asked if I had any suspicions, but I told him no.
You don't think he can help? Summer asked.
Not yet. There's just not enough evidence to be able to point fingers.
We all know someone from the sequestration plant is behind it.
Then we need to find out what the mystery is all about, Trevor replied. He looked at Dirk and Summer steadfastly. I know you're short on time, but can you still oblige me with a search off Gill Island before you have to leave?
Our boat is loaded, and we're more than ready, Dirk replied. Man the lines, and we'll be on our way.
The ride down Douglas Channel was made in relative silence, with each wondering what sort of danger they had stumbled into. As they passed the sequestration facility, Dirk took note that the LNG tanker had departed the covered dock. He nudged the throttle to its stops, anxious to get on sight and see what lay beneath the waters off Gill Island. They were nearly to the sound when Summer stood and pointed out the windshield. The black LNG tanker loomed up around the next bend, steaming slowly down the channel.
Look how low she's sitting, Dirk said, noting that the tanker rode near her waterline.
You were right, Summer, Trevor said. She was, in fact, taking on liquid CO2 at the plant.
It doesn't make any sense.
The Numa vessel charged past the tanker, quickly reaching the open strait. Dirk steered to the southern end of the strait, stopping the boat when he was even with the tip of Gill Island. He moved to the stern and lowered a sonar fish over the rail while Summer programmed a search grid into the navigation system. Within a few minutes, they were underway again, moving back and forth across the strait, with the sonar fish tailing behind. The sonar images revealed a steep and rocky bottom, which dropped from a 50-foot depth near the shoreline to over 200 feet in the center of the strait. Dirk had to play yo-yo with the sonar cable, raising and lowering the fish to match the changing depths. Their first hour of searching revealed little of interest, simply a uniform sea bottom littered with rocks and an occasional sunken log. Trevor quickly grew bored watching the repetitive sonar image and turned his attention to the LNG tanker. The big ship had finally lumbered into the strait, cruising to the north of them at a snail's pace. The tanker eventually inched around the northern tip of Gill Island and disappeared from sight.
I'd love to know where she's headed, Trevor said.
When we get back to Seattle, I'll see if our agency resources can find out, Summer said.
I'd hate to think she's dumping that CO2 at sea.
I can't imagine that would be the case, she replied. It would be too dangerous for the crew if the winds shifted.
I suppose you're right. Still, something just doesn't add up. They were interrupted by Dirk's voice from the cabin. Got something? Summer and Trevor poked their heads in and gazed at the sonar monitor. The screen showed a thin, spindly line on the seafloor that ran off the side.
Might be a pipe, Dirk said. Definitely appears man-made. We should pick up more on the next lane.
They had to wait 10 minutes, turning in front of the island and heading back into the strait on the next lane before they spotted it again. The thin line angled across the monitor, running in a northwesterly direction.
Looks too big to be a communications line, Summer said, studying the monitor.
Hard to figure what would be out here, Trevor remarked. Outside of a few primitive hunting and fishing cabins, Gill Island is uninhabited.
Has to lead somewhere, Dirk said.
As long as it's not buried, we'll be able to find out where. They continued sweeping through the grid, but rather than solve the underwater mystery, they only added to it. A second line soon appeared, and then a third, all aligned in a converging angle to the north. Working their way through several more search lanes, they reached the conjunction. Like a giant seven-fingered hand lying on the bottom, the sonar revealed four additional lines that joined the others in a mass convergence. Piecing the images together, they could see that the lines all fanned out for approximately 50 yards, then ended abruptly. A single heavier line extended north from the conjunction, running parallel to the shoreline. The sonar was able to track the heavy line for a short distance before it suddenly disappeared into the sediment close to shore. When they reached the end of the search grid, Dirk stopped the motor, then pulled in the sonar fish with Trevor's assistance.
It's nearly 7, Summer said. We need to head back within the hour if we want to avoid running up the channel in the dark.
Plenty of time for a quick dive, Dirk replied. Might be our only chance. There was no argument from the others.
Dirk slipped into a dry suit as Summer repositioned the boat over a marked spot where the seven lines had converged. "Depth is 95 feet," she said. "Be aware there is a large vessel on the radar headed our way, about 15 miles to the north." She turned to Trevor and asked, "I thought you said there's no midweek cruise line traffic through here." Trevor gave her a confused look.
"That has been my experience. They follow the schedules pretty tight. Must be a wayward freighter."
Dirk poked his head in and eyed the radar screen.
"I'll have time for a good look before she gets too close."
Summer turned the boat into the current while Trevor tossed an anchor off the bow and secured their position. Dirk adjusted his tank and weight belt, then stepped over the side. He hit the water at nearly slack tide and was relieved to find the current minimal. Swimming toward the boat's bow, he wrapped his fingers around the anchor line, then kicked to the bottom. The cold green water gradually swallowed the surface light, forcing him to flick on a small headlamp strapped over his hood. A brown, stony bottom dotted with urchins and starfish materialized out of the gloom, and he confirmed the depth at 93 feet as he adjusted his buoyancy. He let go of the anchor line and swam a wide circle around it until finding the object observed by the sonar. It was a dark metal pipe that stretched across the seafloor, running beyond his field of vision. The pipe was about 6 inches in diameter, and Dirk could tell it had been placed on the bottom recently, as there was no growth or encrustation evident on its smooth surface. He kicked back to the anchor and dragged it over the pipe, resetting it in some adjacent rocks. He then followed the pipe down a gradual slope into deeper water until he found its open end 20 yards later. A small crater had been blasted into the seafloor around the opening, and Dirk noted a complete absence of marine life in the surrounding area. He followed the pipe in the other direction, swimming into shallower water until meeting the conjunction. It was actually 3 joints welded in tandem that fed 6 lines fanning to either side, plus 1 line out the end. A thicker 10-inch pipe fed into the conjunction, trailing back toward Gill Island. Dirk followed the main pipe for several 100 feet until a 90-degree joint sent it running north at a depth of 30 feet. Tracking it farther, he found it partially buried in a slit trench that had obscured its view from the sonar. He followed the pipe for several more minutes before deciding to give up the chase and turn back, his air supply starting to dwindle. He'd just reversed course when he suddenly detected a rumble under the surface. It was a deep sound, but in the water he could not tell which direction it came from. Following along the pipe, he noticed that sand started to fall away from its sides. He placed a gloved hand on the pipe and felt a strong vibration rattling down its length. With a sudden apprehension, he began kicking urgently toward the junction. On the deck of the boat, Summer looked at her watch, noting that Dirk had been underwater nearly 30 minutes. She turned to Trevor, who sat on the rail watching her with an admiring gaze.
"I wish we could stay here longer," she said, reading his mind.
"Me too. I've been thinking. I'll have to travel to Vancouver to file my report on the boat and see about getting a replacement. It might take me a few days. Longer if I can milk it," he added with a grin. "Any chance I can come see you in Seattle?"
"I'll be angry if you don't," she replied with a smile. "It's only a 3-hour train ride away."
Trevor started to reply when he noticed something in the water over Summer's shoulder. It was a rising surge of bubbles about 20 yards from the boat. He stood to take a better look when Summer pointed to another mass of bubbles a short distance off the bow. In unison, they scanned the surrounding water, spotting a 6 eruptions at various spots around the boat. The rising bubbles expanded into a boiling tempest that began emitting white puffs of vapor. The vapor built rapidly as billowing clouds of white mist emerged from the depths and expanded across the surface. Within seconds, the growing clouds had formed a circular wall around the boat, trapping Summer and Trevor in its center. As the vapor drew closer, Trevor said with alarm,
"It's the devil's breath."
Chapter 44. Thrusting his legs in a powerful scissors kick, Dirk skimmed rapidly along the main pipe.
Though the visibility was too poor to see it, he could sense a nearby turbulence in the water and knew there was something dangerous about the pipe's emissions. The image of the Ventura and its dead crew flashed through his mind. Thinking of Summer and Trevor on the surface, he kicked his fins harder, ignoring the growing protest from his lungs. He reached the pipe junction and immediately veered to his left, following the smaller pipe where he had first dropped down. He could now hear the turbulent rush of bubbles in the water from the high-pressure discharge. Chasing down the pipe, he finally caught sight of the anchor line ahead of him. He immediately shot toward the surface, angling toward the anchor line until joining it just below the boat's bow. When his head broke the surface, he felt like he was in a London fog. A thick white mist billowed low over the water. Keeping his face down, he swam along the hull to the stern, then stepped up a dive ladder Summer had dropped over the rail. He rose up on the lower rung just enough to peer over the transom. The white clouds of vapor floated across the deck, nearly obscuring the pilot house just a few feet away. Dirk pulled his regulator out of his mouth long enough to yell for Summer. An acrid taste immediately filled his mouth, and he shoved the regulator back in and took a breath from his air tank. He stood and listened for several seconds, then stepped off the ladder and dropped into the water, his heart skipping a beat. There had been no reply, he realized, because the boat was empty. 200 yards to the west and 10 feet under the water, Trevor thought he was going to die. He couldn't believe how quickly the frigid water had sapped his strength and energy, and nearly his will to live. If not for the radiant pearl-gray eyes of Summer visibly imploring him on, he might have given up altogether. They were breathtaking eyes, he had to admit, as she shoved the regulator into his mouth for a breath of air. Those eyes, they almost provided warmth by themselves. He took a deep breath of air and passed the regulator back, realizing his mind was slipping. He tried to refocus on his tiring legs and kicked harder, reminding himself that they had to make it to shore. It had been a snap decision, and the only one that would save their lives. With the expanding cloud of carbon dioxide gas completely surrounding them, they had to turn to the water. Summer considered cutting the anchor and making a frantic run through the vapor, but if there was any delay in starting the engine and fleeing, they would die. Plus, there was Dirk's life to consider. If he happened to surface under the stern as they got underway, he could be cut to ribbons. He might have little chance of surviving as it was, but there was always hope he could outswim the gas with his remaining air. "We've got to get into the water," she yelled as the gas erupted. Trevor saw her step toward a fully rigged dive tank on the side rail. "Get into your dry suit. I'll grab the tank," he directed. With less than a minute before the boat was engulfed by vapor, Summer jumped into her dry suit and grabbed a mask while Trevor hastily buckled on the tank. She barely had time to slip her arms through his buoyancy vest straps when the carbon dioxide wafted over the boat. They fell more than jumped over the side, splashing loudly into the cold water and submerging beneath the lethal cloud. Unprotected from the cold, Trevor felt the immersion like an electric shock. But his adrenaline was pumping so hard that he didn't freeze up. Clinging together face to face, they kicked awkwardly through the water, passing the regulator back and forth for shared air. They eventually worked into something of a rhythm and soon made good headway toward the island. But the cold quickly caught up with Trevor. The effects were imperceptible at first, but then Summer noticed his kicking slow. His lips and ears showed a tinge of blue, and she knew he was drifting toward hypothermia. She increased her kicking pace, not wanting to lose their momentum. She struggled another 100 feet, realizing that he was slowly becoming a dead weight. She looked down, hoping to find the seafloor rising up beneath them, but all she could see was a few feet of murky water. She had no clue as to how far they were from the island or whether they had, in fact, been swimming around in circles. The time had come to risk surfacing. Taking a deep breath from the regulator before forcing it back into Trevor's mouth, she kicked to the surface, yanking him with her. Breaking the calm surface, she quickly spun her head in all directions, trying to get her bearings. Her worst fear proved to be unfounded. They had escaped, at least temporarily, the thick clouds of carbon dioxide, which still billowed into the sky a short distance away. In the opposite direction, the green hills of Gill Island beckoned less than a quarter mile away. Although they had not swum in a direct line, their course had been true enough to approach the shoreline. Summer sampled a few breaths of air without consequence, then reached under Trevor's arm and pressed the inflate button on his buoyancy compensator. The vest quickly inflated, raising Trevor's torso from beneath the water. She looked at his face and he winked in reply, but his eyes were dull and listless. Grabbing the back of the BC, she kicked toward shore, towing him behind her while he loosely flopped his feet. The island seemed to keep its distance as fatigue caught up with Summer, who was already burdened by a sense of desperation to get Trevor ashore. She tried to keep her eyes off the shoreline and just focus on kicking, but that only made her realize how leaden her legs felt. She was struggling to keep her pace when Trevor's BC suddenly jerked out of her hands and his body moved ahead of hers. Startled by his movements, she let go in surprise, observing that his limbs still hung limp. Then a head emerged from the water alongside Trevor's chest. Dirk turned and gazed at Summer, then spat out his regulator.
"He must be frozen. Did he inhale the gas?" he asked. "No, it's just the cold. We've got to get him to shore. How did you find us?"
"I saw a dive tank was missing from the boat and figured you were making for shore. I surfaced a little to the south and spotted you." Without another word, they made for the island as quickly as they could. Dirk's appearance served as a morale boost to Summer, and she suddenly swam with renewed vigor. Together they moved briskly through the water with Trevor in tow and soon yanked him up onto a thin band of rocky beachfront. Shivering uncontrollably, Trevor sat up on his own but stared off into space.
"We've got to get his wet clothes off. I'll give him my dry suit to wear," Dirk said.
Summer nodded in agreement, then pointed down the beach. A small wooden structure sat perched over the water 100 yards down the shoreline.
"Looks like a fishing hut.
Why don't you check it out and I'll get his clothes off?" "Okay," Dirk said, slipping off his tank and weight belt. "Don't enjoy yourself too much," he chided, then turned and headed down the beach. He wasted no time, realizing Trevor was in real danger. Jogging in his dry suit, he crossed the distance to the structure in short order. Summer was right. It was a small fishing hut, used for overnight excursions by members of a local fishing club. A simple log structure, it was smaller than a one-car garage. Dirk noted a 55-gallon drum and a cord of chopped wood stacked along an exterior wall. He approached the front door and promptly kicked it open, finding a single cot, a wood-burning stove, and a fish smoker. Spotting a box of matches and a small stack of dry wood, he promptly ignited a small fire in the stove, then hustled back down the beach. Trevor was sitting on a log shirtless as Summer removed his soaking pants. Dirk helped him to his feet, and with Summer on the other side, they half-dragged him toward the cabin. As they moved, Dirk and Summer both gazed out at the strait. The white clouds of CO2 were still surging from the water like a volcanic eruption. The vapor had swelled into a towering mass that stretched across the strait, rising over 50 feet into the air. They noted a reddish tinge in the water and saw dozens of dead fish bobbing on the surface.
"It must be the LNG tanker," Dirk said. "They're probably pumping it from a terminal on the other side of the island." "But why do it in broad daylight?"
"Because they know we're here," he said quietly, a touch of anger in his voice. They reached the cabin and lay Trevor down on the cot. Summer covered him with an old wool blanket while Dirk brought in some of the cut wood from outside. The stove had already started warming the small hut, and Dirk fed more wood on the fire until a small blaze was roaring. He stood to fetch some more wood when a deep bellow echoed in the distance, reverberating off the island hillsides. Dirk and Summer rushed outside and looked up the strait in horror. 2 miles to the north, a large Alaskan cruise liner was making its way down the passage, heading directly toward the lethal bank of carbon dioxide gas.
Chapter 45.
The French cruise liner Dauphine was scheduled for a week-long voyage up the Alaskan coast before returning to its home port of Vancouver. But a major outbreak of gastrointestinal illness had sickened nearly 300 passengers, forcing the captain to shorten the trip in fear that a large number would require hospitalization. At just over 950 feet, the Dauphine was one of the largest, as well as newest, cruise ships plying the inside passage.
with 3 heated swimming pools, 8 restaurants, and an enormous glass-walled observation lounge above the bridge, she carried 2,100 passengers in high comfort and luxury. Standing on the Gill Island shoreline, Dirk and Summer gazed at the gleaming white liner on approach and saw only a ship of death. The toxic carbon dioxide gas still erupted from the 7 pipe outlets, expanding the vapor cloud for over a half mile in every direction. A slight westerly breeze kept the gas away from Gill Island, but pushed it farther across the strait. The Dauphine would take nearly 5 minutes to pass through the cloud, ample time for the heavy carbon dioxide to infiltrate the ducts and air conditioning systems throughout the vessel. Displacing the oxygen in the air, the gas would bring quick death to every portion of the ship.
"There must be thousands of people aboard," Summer observed soberly. "We've got to warn them."
"Maybe there's a radio in the hut," Dirk said. They bolted into the fishing hut, ignoring the mumblings from Trevor as they tore the small shack apart. But there was no radio. Stepping outside, Dirk looked into the billow of white gas, trying to spot the research boat. It was hopelessly concealed inside the vapor cloud. "How much air do you have left in your tank?" he asked Summer hurriedly. "I can try to get back to the boat and call them on the marine radio, but I sucked my tank dry."
"No, you can't," Summer said, shaking her head. "My tank is almost empty as well, because we had to share air. You'd never make it back to the boat alive. I won't let you go."
Dirk accepted his sister's plea, knowing it would likely be a fatal attempt. He desperately searched around, looking for some way to alert the ship. Then he spotted the large barrel next to the hut. Rushing over to the grime-covered drum, he placed his hands against the top lid and shoved. The barrel resisted, then lifted with a slight sloshing sound, telling him it was nearly full. He unscrewed a cap on the top and stuck a finger in, then sniffed the liquid inside. "Gasoline," he said as Summer approached. "An extra supply for the fishermen to refuel their boats."
"We can light a bonfire," Summer suggested excitedly.
"Yes," Dirk said with a slow nod. "Or perhaps something a little more conspicuous." The Dauphine's captain happened to be on the bridge checking the weather forecast when the executive officer called to him.
"Captain, there appears to be an obstruction in the water directly ahead."
The captain finished reading the weather report, then casually stepped over to the exec, who held a pair of high-powered binoculars to his eyes. With the whales, dolphins, and stray logs from the lumber boats, there always appeared to be floating obstructions in the passage. None of it was ever cause for concern to the big ship, which just plowed through any debris like so many toothpicks.
"Half a mile ahead, sir," the exec said, passing over the binoculars.
The captain raised the glasses, viewing a billowing white cloud of fog in their path. Just ahead of the fog was a low-lying object in the water that sprouted a black hump and a smaller adjacent blue hump. The captain studied the object for nearly a minute, adjusting the focus of the binoculars.
"There's a man in the water," he suddenly blurted. "Looks to be a diver. Helm, decrease speed to 5 knots and prepare for a course adjustment."
He handed the binoculars back to the exec, then stepped over to a color monitor, which displayed their position against a nautical chart of the passage. He studied the immediate water depths, finding with satisfaction that there was plenty of water on the eastern side of the strait to sail through. He was about to give the helmsman a course adjustment to veer around the diver when the exec called out again.
"Sir, I think you better take another look. There's someone on the shore that appears to be signaling us."
The captain grabbed the binoculars a second time and looked ahead. The ship had advanced enough that he could now clearly see Dirk in his blue dry suit swimming along a floating Y-shaped log. Wedged into the log's joint was a 55-gallon drum. He watched as Dirk waved to the shore, then pushed away from the log and disappeared under the water. The captain swung his gaze toward the shore, where he spotted Summer wading up to her chest in the water. She held a shard of wood over her head that appeared to be burning. He watched in disbelief as she flung the burning stick out into the channel toward the floating log. When the burning embers hit the water, the surface immediately ignited in a thin burst of flames. A narrow trail of fire slowly snaked to the floating log, engulfing the driftwood in a flickering blaze.
It took just a few additional seconds for the gasoline vapors inside the barrel to ignite, erupting in a small explosion that sent the shattering drum careening across the water. The captain stared bewildered at the fiery scene, then finally came to his senses.
"Full astern! Full astern!" he shouted, waving his arms in excitement. "Then someone get me the Coast Guard!"
Chapter 46. Dirk surfaced 20 yards from the burning gasoline and lazily swam in the direction of the cruise ship, occasionally raising one arm and slapping it down to the surface in the diver's signal for distress. He cautiously eyed the carbon dioxide cloud, which was still burgeoning a few dozen yards behind the burning log. He could hear shouts from the shore and glanced over to see Summer yelling and waving at the ship to halt. He looked north to see the massive ship still bearing down on him. He began to wonder if anyone was awake on the bridge and had even seen his pyrotechnic display. Questioning his own safety in the path of the ship, he turned and swam a few strokes toward the shore. Then he heard the distant wail of an alarm sounding on board. The water near the vessel's stern caught his eye as it churned into a turbulent boil. Dirk realized the fiery signal had in fact been seen and that the captain had reversed engines. But he began to wonder if it was too late. The Dauphine continued gliding toward the toxic cloud without any appearance of slowing. Dirk swam harder to avoid the oncoming bow of the ship as it bore down on him. Its towering presence drew over him, the bow cutting the water just yards away. All but giving up hope that the ship would stop, he suddenly detected the liner shudder and falter. The ship's bow eased up to the dying line of flames, then ground to a halt. With a pained slowness, the Dauphine began backing up the strait, moving 100 yards to the north before drifting to a stationary position. A small orange launch had already been lowered over the side and quickly raced toward Dirk. As it pulled alongside, two crewmen reached over and roughly yanked him aboard. An austere-faced man seated at the stern growled at him.
"What kind of fool are you?"
"Greenpeace," he asked in a French accent. Dirk pointed to the billowing white vapor to the south of them. "Sail into that and you'll be a dead man. You be the fool and ignore my warning." He paused, staring the crewman in the eye. Flustered and suddenly unsure of himself, the Frenchman remained quiet. "I have an injured man ashore who requires immediate medical attention," Dirk continued, pointing to the fishing hut. Without another word, they raced the launch to shore. Dirk jumped off the boat and ran to the hut, which was now blazing hot from the stove fire. Summer was seated with her arm around Trevor, talking to him on the cot. His eyes looked brighter, but he still mumbled in a state of grogginess. The launch crewman helped carry him to the boat, and they all returned to the Dauphine. After Trevor was hoisted aboard in the launch, Summer accompanied him to the ship's medical station while Dirk was escorted to the bridge. The ship's captain, a short man with thinning hair, looked him up and down with an air of disdain.
"Who are you, and why did you set fire in our path?" he asked pointedly.
"My name is Pitt, from the National Underwater and Marine Agency. You can't proceed down the strait or you'll kill everyone aboard. That white mist ahead of you is a lethal cloud of carbon dioxide gas being discharged by a tanker ship. We had to abandon our boat and swim to shore, and my sister and another man barely escaped death." The executive officer stood nearby, listening. He shook his head and snickered.
"What an absurd tale," he said to another crewman loud enough for Dirk to hear.
Dirk ignored him, standing toe-to-toe with the captain. "What I have said is true. If you want to risk killing the thousands of passengers aboard, then go right ahead. Just put us ashore before you proceed." The captain studied Dirk's face, searching for signs of lunacy, but finding only stone-cold reserve. A crewman at the radar station broke the tension.
"Sir, we are showing a stationary vessel in the fog bank, approximately 1/2 mile off our starboard bow."
The captain digested the information without comment, then looked again at Dirk.
"Very well. We shall alter course and avoid farther progress through the strait. Incidentally, the Coast Guard is on their way. If you are mistaken, Mr. Pitt, then you will be subject to their prosecution."
A minute later, a thumping noise approached and an orange and white U.S. Coast Guard helicopter from Prince Rupert appeared out the port window. "Captain, if you would,
Please advise the pilot to avoid flying into or above the white cloud. It might prove enlightening if he also did a flyby around the northwest coast of Gill Island, Dirk requested. The captain obliged, advising the Coast Guard pilot of the situation. The helicopter disappeared for 20 minutes, then reappeared above the cruise ship and called on the radio. Dauphine, we have confirmed the presence of an LNG tanker at a floating terminal on the north coast of Gill Island. It appears you may be correct about an unlawful discharge of gas. We are issuing marine hazard warnings through the Canadian Coast Guard and Royal Canadian Mounted Police. Advise you to alter course to the channel west of Gill Island. The captain thanked the Coast Guard pilot, then configured an alternate route around Gill Island. A few minutes later, he approached Dirk.
It would seem that you have saved my ship from an immeasurable tragedy, Mr. Pitt. I apologize for our skepticism, and thank you for the warning. If there is anything at all I can do to repay you, please let me know.
Dirk thought for a minute, then said, Well, Captain, at some point, I would like to have my boat back. Dirk and Summer had little choice but to remain aboard the Dauphine until she docked in Vancouver late the following evening. Trevor was back on his feet by the time they reached port, but was sent to the hospital for overnight observation. Dirk and Summer stopped for a visit before catching a train to Seattle.
"Are you finally thawed out?" Summer asked, finding Trevor under a mountain of blankets in the hospital room.
"Yes, and now they're trying to cook me alive," he replied, happy to see her so soon. "Next time, I get the dry suit."
"Deal,"
she said with a laugh. "Have they nailed the LNG tanker?" he asked, turning serious.
"The Dauphine saw her headed to sea as we skirted around Gill Island, so they must have cut and run once they saw the helicopter. Fortunately, the Coast Guard chopper had their video camera rolling, and so captured them at the floating terminal."
"No doubt they'll be able to trace the ship back to one of Goyette's holdings," Dirk added, "though he'll find a way to pawn off the blame."
"That's what killed my brother," Trevor said solemnly. "They almost got us, too."
"Did Summer tell you that she deciphered your brother's message on the Ventura?" Dirk said.
"No," he said, suddenly sitting up in bed and staring at Summer. "I've been thinking about it ever since we found the Ventura," she said. "It came to me on the ship last night. His message wasn't that they choked. It was that they suffered from choke damp."
"I'm not familiar with the term," Trevor said.
"It comes from the old mining days, when underground miners carried canaries with them to warn of asphyxiation. I had run across the term while investigating an old flooded quarry in Ohio that was rumored to contain pre-Columbian artifacts. Your brother was a doctor, so he would have been familiar with it. I believe he tried to write the message as a warning to others."
"Have you told anyone else?" Trevor asked.
"No," Summer replied. "I figured you'll want to have another chat with the chief of police in Kitimat when you return."
Trevor nodded but turned away from Summer with a faraway look in his eyes. "We've got a train to catch," Dirk said, eyeing the clock. "Let's try a warm water dive together real soon," he said to Trevor, shaking his hand. Summer moved in and gave him a passionate kiss.
"Now remember, Seattle is only 100 miles away."
"Yes," Trevor smiled. "And there's no telling how long I'll have to stay in Vancouver arranging a new boat." "He'll probably be behind the wheel before we see ours again," Dirk lamented as they walked out. But he would be proven wrong. 2 days after returning to the NUMA regional office in Seattle, a flatbed truck showed up carrying their research boat left behind off Gill Island. It had a full tank of gas, and on the pilot's seat was an expensive bottle of French Burgundy.
Chapter 47.
By presidential directive, the U.S. Coast Guard cutter Polar Dawn steamed stridently across the maritime boundary with Canada just north of the Yukon. As it moved east across the corrugated gray waters of the Beaufort Sea, Captain Edwin Murdoch stared out the bridge window in silent relief. There was no armed Canadian flotilla there to challenge him, as a few aboard the ship had feared.
Their mission had begun innocuously enough several months earlier with a proposal to seismically map the periphery sea ice along the Northwest Passage. However, this was well before the Atlanta and Ice Research Lab 7 incidents. The president, concerned about fanning the flames of Canadian indignation, had initially canceled the voyage, but the Secretary of Defense had finally convinced him to proceed with the mission, successfully arguing that the Canadians had previously given implicit approval. It might be years, he asserted, before the U.S. could challenge Canada's internal waters claim without overt provocation. "Skies clear, radar screen empty, and seas at 324, said the Polar Dawn's executive officer, a rail-thin African-American named Wilkes. Perfect conditions in which to run the passage.
Let's hope they continue for the next 6 days, Murdoch replied.
He noticed a glint in the sky out the starboard bridge window.
Our upstairs escort is still holding the trail? He asked. I believe they are going to keep an eye on us for the first 50 miles into Canadian waters, Wilkes replied, referring to a Navy P-3 Orion reconnaissance plane that lazily circled overhead. After that, we're on our own. Nobody really expected the Canadians to oppose them, but the ship's officers and crew were well aware of the heated rhetoric that had been erupting from Ottawa the past 2 weeks. Most recognized it for what it was, empty posturing by some politicians attempting to capture a few votes. Or so they hoped. The Polar Dawn moved east through the Beaufort Sea, skirting along the jagged edge of the sea ice that occasionally crumbled into a mass of irregular-shaped floes. The Coast Guard vessel towed a sled-shaped seismic sensor off the stern, which mapped the depth and density of the ice sheet as they steamed by. The waters held clear of traffic, save for the occasional fishing boat or oil exploration vessel. Sailing through the first brief Arctic night without incident, Murdoch slowly began to relax. The crew settled into their varied work schedules, which would serve them for the nearly 3-week voyage to New York Harbor. The sea ice had encroached closer to the mainland as they sailed east, gradually constricting the open waterway to less than 30 miles as they approached the Amundsen Gulf, south of Banks Island. Passing the 500-mile mark from Alaska, Murdoch was surprised that they still hadn't encountered any Canadian picket vessels. He had been briefed that 2 Canadian Coast Guard vessels regularly patrolled the Amundsen Gulf, picking up any eastbound freighters that hadn't paid their passage fees.
"Victoria Island coming into view," Wilkes announced. All eyes on the bridge strained to make out the tundra-covered island through a damp gray haze. Larger than the state of Kansas, the huge island pressed a 400-mile-long coastline opposite the North American mainland. The waterway ahead of the Polar Dawn constricted again as they entered the Dolphin and Union Strait, named for 2 small boats used by Franklin on an earlier Arctic expedition. The ice shelf crept off both shorelines, narrowing the open seaway through the strait to less than 10 miles. The Polar Dawn could easily shove through the adjacent meter-thick ice if necessary, but the ship kept to the ice-free path melted by the warm spring weather. The Polar Dawn forged another 100 miles through the narrowing strait as its second Arctic night in Canadian waters approached. Murdoch had just returned to the bridge after a late dinner when the radar operator announced first one and then another surface contact.
"They're both stationary at the moment," the operator said. "One's to the north, the other almost directly south. We'll run right between them on our current heading."
"Our picket has finally appeared," Murdoch said quietly.
As they approached the 2 vessels, a larger ship appeared on the radar some 10 miles ahead. The sentry vessels remained silent as the Polar Dawn cruised past, one on either flank. As the Coast Guard ship moved on unchallenged, Murdoch stepped over to the radar station and peered over the operator's shoulder. With a measure of chagrin, he watched as the 2 vessels slowly departed their stations and gradually fell in line behind his own ship.
"It appears we may have trouble passing go in collecting our $200, he said to Wilkes.
"The radio is still silent," the exec observed. "Maybe they're just bored."
A hazy dusk had settled over the strait, painting the distant shoreline of Victoria Island a deep purple. Murdoch tried to observe the ship ahead through a pair of binoculars, but could only make out a dark gray mass from the bow profile.
The captain adjusted course slightly so as to pass the ship on his port side with plenty of leeway, but he would never get the chance. In the fading daylight, they closed within 2 miles of the larger ship when a sudden spray of orange light burst from its gray shadow. The Polar Dawn's bridge crew heard a faint whistling, then saw an explosion in the water a quarter mile off their starboard bow. The startled crew watched as the spray of water from the blast rose 40 feet into the air. "They fired a shell at us," Wilkes blurted in a shocked voice. A second later, the long, silent radio finally crackled. "Polar Dawn, Polar Dawn, this is the Canadian warship Manitoba. You are trespassing in a sovereign waterway. Please heave to and prepare for boarding." Murdoch reached for a radio transmitter. "Manitoba, this is the captain of the Polar Dawn. Our transit route has been filed with the Foreign Affairs Ministry in August.